It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's Politics Wednesday edition of our program. Dave Anderson is with us, assistant professor of political science at Iowa State University in our Ames studio. Hi, Dave.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. Renee Rocha is with us, associate professor of political science at the University of Iowa in our Iowa City studio. Renee, hi.
Thanks for having me on, Ben.
Thank you for being with us, both of you. With your analysis this hour, we'd like to have our listeners join us as well. We're going to be talking about a number of topics a little later in the hour. This neck-and-neck race, the gubernatorial race, locked in a tight race, Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds and businessman Fred Hubbell, according to the polls. It's a very close race. We'll ask for Dave and Renee's analysis of that later on. Also, what's just hit the news in the last 24 hours, President Trump's wish to end birthright citizenship through an executive order. That coming up a little bit later as well. Join our conversation on any of these points, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org, our email. Let's talk a little bit about the aftermath of one of the deadliest anti-Semitic acts in U.S. history. Funeral services yesterday for the 11 people who were killed at the synagogue in Pittsburgh began yesterday. Also a day when the president visited the city. He was welcomed by some. He was opposed by others. Those in the city against his visit say his rhetoric has contributed to this national atmosphere of anger. The president and first lady paid respects at the Tree of Life Synagogue. That's where the gunman, screaming, "All Jews must die," attacked on Saturday. The president met with officers who were wounded in the shooting, also met with a widow of one of the victims. There were those protests, though, as well. Thousands of protesters holding signs that read such things as "Words matter" and "President hate is not welcome in our state." Dave, what are you seeing in this political reaction to the massacre?
Well, I think it's hard on both sides to figure out how to respond to something like this. No politician, no person, I think, endorses violence, especially political violence. But it seems like acts of violence are just becoming recurrent and common within the United States. And a lot of people are wondering whether it's our political rhetoric and the tone of our politics that is contributing to this. I think a lot of people are blaming the president because he is notably attacking anybody he disagrees with. And that seems to legitimize to the rest of the country that we should be free to attack people that we don't agree with. And some people take that into a physical form of violence.
Mm-hmm. How are we to know whether or to what degree such acts are connected with a national atmosphere, division, the fear and the hatred that has been stirred up in the country?
Well, I don't think with any instance you were likely to ever figure it out precisely, unless the attacker says, "I did this because of my political beliefs and I was motivated by the president or somebody else."
Mm-hmm. But states it flatly straight away.
Yeah. Otherwise, I think it's kind of like global warming. You can't attribute any hurricane to global warming, but you can say that because of global climate change, hurricanes are probably going to become stronger and they're going to become more frequent. And I think much is the same about our political tone right now in the country.
Renee, what do you make of this debate, the blame from both sides?
Yeah, well, you know, you did see the president after the aftermath of Charlottesville sort of make this argument that there were good people on both sides, sort of diminish some of the culpability that was on the sort of neo-Nazi protesters. That sort of started this idea that the Trump administration, in refusing to condemn far-right extremism or white nationalism, was sort of validating in some way the movement, right? And I think that's behind a lot of the objections to the president coming to Pittsburgh, part of the reason that he wasn't really embraced by many public officials, mm-hmm. you know, when he entered the city. It seems like an understandable source of hesitation on their part, which isn't to say that the president, as Dave was just saying, directly caused it. I don't think anyone's asserting that the president's rhetoric is directly responsible for this. But the idea is that sort of, you know, again, sort of validating and invigorating this movement is going to encourage people who to, you know, engage in behaviors that, you know, are way outside the norms of, you know, what's allowable and in some cases really sort of extreme acts of violence.
Mm-hmm. Presidents often visit the aftermath of natural and man-made disasters. This is a massacre. Was the president, you think, Dave, in sort of a no-win situation? He was criticized for coming there too early, but Had he not gone or had he waited, he would have been criticized as well, right?
Absolutely. It was a no-win situation. And I think we're just going to continue to see this throughout President Trump's term, because a lot of the country just wants nothing to do with this president. And a lot of the country really does like this president and enjoy his presence. And it means any time there's a national tragedy, a national emergency, a time when we would normally expect presidential leadership, I think, regardless of circumstances, half the country is going to oppose his presence and half the country is going to demand it.
Mm-hmm. At the same time, the Anti-Defamation League has been looking at the historic rise in anti-Semitic incidents for many months and warning about it for many months. But it came out with this news as well, the biggest single-year increase in reported anti-Jewish hate since they started tracking such data almost 40 years ago. Also here in Iowa, a rise of from no incidents of anti-Semitism in 2016 to 9 in 2017. But if you look at their website, at maps that display the anti-Semitic, anti-Jewish incidents here, Rene, it's across the board.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if there's one group that doesn't believe that there are some good people amongst a group of neo-Nazis, it's probably, Jewish Americans, right? This is a little bit unique. I think President Johnson was the first president to visit the aftermath of a hurricane, and ever since then, we've had this tradition of presidents going to instances of natural disaster, national tragedy. And we've had a polarized country for many years, and, the Bush administration, the Obama administration, both divided our country in significant ways, but never did we have it to this extreme. Never did we have a President Bush or President Obama enter a situation and be so, not embraced, be so distanced by public officials within the locality they are visiting, and also by sort of national figures. You saw Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan sort of refusing to go along with President Trump. So, polarization has been with us for a long time. And I think that what we're seeing now is something different under the current administration.
Mm-hmm. Dave, different in degree or quality?
I think we're maybe... It's such a difference in degree that we're getting into a difference in quality or different in kind, that just the country seems to become resistant lately to opposite political party beliefs, political partisans. And I don't think there's anything that President Trump could come out and say or do to convince a lot of Democrats and even moderates and independents right now to listen to him or to like him. And similarly, I think what we're seeing is there's nothing he can do to convince a lot of Republicans and conservatives not to like him. We're just all getting very polarized in our beliefs.
Mm-hmm. If you just joined us, Dave Anderson with us, and Rene Rocha, political scientist. Rene from the University of Iowa, Dave from Iowa State University. Politics Wednesday edition. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Well, let's talk about the news from the last 24 hours, this interview that the president had with Axios on HBO. He's spoke and revealed his intentions to change law written into the U.S. Constitution guaranteeing citizenship to children born in the U.S. Trump says he could do this change through an executive order, although the legality of this claim has been widely disputed.
Some legal scholars believe you can get rid of birthright citizenship without changing the Constitution.
With an executive order.
Exactly.
Right.
Have you thought about that?
Yes.
Tell me more.
It was always told to me that you needed a constitutional amendment.
Right. 14th Amendment.
You don't. Number one, you don't need that. Number two,
I mean, that's in dispute.
You could definitely,
that's very much in dispute.
Well, you can definitely do it with an act of Congress, but now they're saying I can do it just with an executive order. Now, how ridiculous. We're the only country in the world where a person comes in, has a baby, and the baby is essentially a citizen of the United States for 85 years with all of those benefits. It's ridiculous, and it has to end.
Okay. First to the legal question, can the president do this by executive order, Rene?
No.
Why?
I'm old enough to remember when the Obama administration tried to make significant changes to immigration policy via executive order.
Don't have to be too old to do that.
Exactly. And conservatives really lambasted him, and those were obviously much more moderate in scale. It's a constitutional amendment, and initially, I sort of wrote off this statement. The president didn't proactively announce that he was going to make this change via executive order. He was asked about it in an interview, so it was a very reactive statement. It was not necessarily clear that this was something he was planning to do. However, I think that the attention that has come from it and the sort of energizing effect it's had on his base maybe has encouraged him to think about pursuing the idea with, you know, a little bit more vigor. You saw the president on Twitter this morning really sort of going off about it.
Right. And to your point, energizing his base, even if it's not something he even believes himself he can do by executive order, it would still energize the base, possibly, if that was his intention.
Exactly. And, you know, his most important goal here is to energize the base over the next week. So I don't think we're going to see an executive order in the next week. And so maybe this is something that he'll continue to talk about doing. But as long as it's hanging out there, it's something which can potentially motivate Republicans of a certain stripe to vote next week.
Now, what we're talking about is the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, holding that, and I quote, all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States. Dave, what do you make of all this discussion of this birthright citizenship?
I feel like President Trump is almost transitioning from just energizing the base to almost daring his base to not believe him. Some of the things he's done in the last week, from sending the military down to the border supposedly to confront the caravan, the 10% middle class tax cut that is not possible to pass, and then with this, these are things that have real no chance of happening. These are not real policy things. They're not necessarily addressing real issues. It is just the president saying really flamboyant, extravagant things, trying to get his base fired up, and I feel like he's almost daring them to disbelieve.
All right. I heard this described in one article as the president throwing, in the final days before the election, throwing everything at the wall and seeing what sticks.
Yeah, I mean,
that seems to be what you're saying.
We often talk about throwing red meat to the base to get them riled up, but I feel like this is the classic trick of pretending to throw a ball to a dog and seeing if it chases. And President Trump just keeps throwing a fake ball, and his base keeps chasing.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to our phones, 1-866-780-9100, Politics Wednesday with Dave Anderson, Renee Rocha. Reggie is with us in Oskaloosa. Hi, Reggie.
Yes, I want to say that the 14th Amendment, when it was originally written, was to make freed slaves citizens. Jacob Howard, the author of the 14th Amendment, said it did not include foreigners.
Mm-hmm.
That was the original intent. So in 1965, when the ruling came out that it did include illegal alien children, I believe that was a deliberate misinterpretation by an activist judge. And everything Trump does, it automatically goes to the court because it's, you know, disputed by someone, and it goes through the courts.
Okay, let's get a comment on that. Reggie in Oskaloosa, thank you. Renee, I think you wanted to say something there.
Yeah, well, you know, before we had that situation, that court case in 1965, one of the first confrontations we dealt with in terms of the 14th Amendment was what to do with Chinese immigrants who were having children in the late 1800s. You know, the caller is correct. The intent of the amendment originally, or at least its motivation, was designed to deal with questions about extending enfranchisement and rights to African Americans. We quickly realized that we had a large Chinese immigrant population in the late 1800s. They were having children, and those children were being extended citizenship. The solution at that point in time was not to say that the 14th Amendment didn't apply to them. We initially actually banned Chinese women from entering the United States, and then eventually we followed up with the Chinese Exclusion Act, right? Precisely in part because we knew that Chinese immigrants having children in the United States would be granted the protections of the 14th Amendment. So we've been pretty sure about this for, you know, well over 100 years now.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to another caller. Hayes with us in Coon Rapids. Hi, Hayes. Welcome to the program.
Hello, and thank you, Renee, for setting this record straight on the 14th Amendment. I appreciate the clarification on that, because I think that people like your previous caller get their wires crossed a bit listening to the gentleman who was on Morning Edition this morning trying to defend the 14th, challenging the 14th Amendment. But so thank you, Renee, for straightening that out. I guess I took a bit of an exception to something that one of your panelists said earlier, that there's nothing that Donald Trump could do or say or act differently that would make independents or moderates or libertarians such as myself think about him differently or like him. And it's not so much that he could change and make people who don't like him like him, but there absolutely are things that Donald Trump could change about what he says and what he does to act more presidential. And bring the country together. And you touched on that a little bit earlier about he seems to just be fanning the flames. I saw a political cartoon yesterday that showed Donald Trump as the match and all these angry bombs, us as Americans, ready to go off. And I just think that there is absolutely a lot that he could say or do differently. He just it doesn't work to his advantage to do so.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Hayes, thank you for your perspective from Coon Rapids. Thank you. Anything to add to those callers before we move on?
Yeah, I somewhat agree that there are things that President Trump could do to try to bring the nation together. I just don't see much of a path for it to actually happen. President Trump is very authentic to what he believes. He says what's on his mind. He does not have a filter. And 2 years into his presidency, I think he has both dug a hole with so many of his detractors and put himself on a pedestal with so many of his supporters that it would be a long process of changing anybody's mind. It's not that he can deliver a speech or get behind a policy and minds will start changing.
Right, right. Could you have said the same thing about President Obama after some years in office, that people had their views sort of crystallized, whatever
Absolutely.
Term you want to, and then almost before even the words come out of his mouth about a new initiative or something like that, that the opinion's already formed? Is that what you're saying, Dave?
Yes, by probably 2012 or 2013, most Americans had very hardened feelings about President Obama, and they either loved him and looked forward to every speech he gave, or they hated him and were loath to listen to a word he said.
Yeah, and, you know, sort of part of the question is what we're thinking about here. Do we expect people to approve of Donald Trump? Do we expect people to vote for Donald Trump? Or do we just want to have a point in which we change rhetoric and change the dynamics in our country such that we, even though we disagree with the president, even though we have some people have no intention of voting for him, they still can use him as the president to bring us together in particular moments, right? To bring some consultation mm-hmm. to us in moments of national tragedy. That, I think, is the sort of level we're looking for, right? Of allowing some people to do that rather than even just, you know, straight up supporting him.
Mm-hmm. Renee, I know you do a lot of work in the area of immigration. Back to this birthright citizenship question. I'm wondering if birthright citizenship is an overall economic plus or minus when we weigh it on that scale. For instance, we live in a state where many employers can't find enough people to fill jobs. It's can be seen as an obstacle to growth. So we have also seen an explosion in demand for ESL teachers and services in our schools. So is immigration, legal or otherwise, an economic driver or depleter for us here in Iowa?
Yeah, I mean, population growth is a positive economic force, right? And immigration is a part of that. You know, most economists who study this, in fact, not even most, basically every economist, finds that immigration has a positive economic benefit. It increases productivity, right? That might be a separate issue from should you expand the number of immigrants for other reasons. Maybe people have social or cultural concerns, but economic concerns are really not part of the equation here. And if you're going to have individuals who are born in the United States and raised in the United States, then the economic benefit for us all is to have those people be able to be full parts of the economy, full parts of society, which individuals who are not documented simply cannot be.
Mm-hmm. Dave, to finish up on this, talk a little bit about how the president's words here and, what the GOP leadership, Paul Ryan caught off guard, Mitch McConnell probably caught off guard, Paul Ryan saying you can definitely not do this. I'm trying to get the quote here that he, but this just rejected from people in his own party, right?
Yes. And as the caller was saying earlier, even if you dispute the constitutionality of birthright citizenship and the meaning that it has been given from the Supreme Court, the only way we change the meaning of that is to go back to the Supreme Court and have the Supreme Court reinterpret the amendment. You can't just, as president, say, I'm going to issue an executive order and change the meaning of the Constitution. It doesn't work like that. And if it did work like that, the Constitution would mean absolutely nothing. We would just have a president who told us what the meaning of the Constitution was every 4 years.
Why would the president be doing this then after Republicans for years heavily criticized Barack Obama for his executive orders, Rene. I mean, it seems to be counting on an extremely short political memory on the part of Americans, right?
That actually appears to be working out, right? I mean, I haven't seen any polling on this, but I imagine that, the number of Republicans who approve of that particular action will be in excess of the number of Republicans that approved of President Obama's action, despite the fact that they're both structurally using executive orders, and despite the fact that the president was using his executive authority to change the way in which immigration enforcement was implemented, and the president's trying to use it to make some kind of constitutional structural reform. Mm-hmm. I think the president isn't really concerned about those details. The president's concerned with an overall general theme of I am tough on immigration, and I will do as many tough things as I can. I will send 5,000 troops to the border to deal with a caravan that involves less people than that.
Okay, right? So set the record straight here, Rene. These thousands of people are being characterized as an invasion to our country. They're, 900 miles away, most of them on foot.
Yeah.
This is being cast as a national security issue.
Started at around 7,000, is about half that now, would be less than that at the point in which you arrived. Which, to give you a sense of scale, in 2014, when we had the sort of unaccompanied minor crisis, mm-hmm. that involved 40,000 people showing up in the Rio Grande Valley within the span of a single month. 40,000. This caravan is already a tenth of that. It'll be even less by the time it gets here. So in terms of just like scale as to what we're used to in border activity, it's actually not that large, right? It's just that it's a particular event which the president has used and politicized and sort of weaponized in this way.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a quick call. Keith in Iowa Falls. Keith, I'm sorry, we're coming up to a break. You'll have to make it quick, but welcome to the program. Keith, are you there? Keith is gone. All right. Well, we hope you'll join us in the next half hour. We'll come up to a break here. In the next half hour, we're going to be talking about the governor's race. When we return after a short break, it's less than a week away from Election Day, of course. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds locked in this tight race against the businessman Fred Hubble. It's viewed as one of the most competitive gubernatorial contests in the country. What's making it so competitive, and what issues are each of the candidates emphasizing? And what do we think will be the turnout here in terms of voters? Are the voters energized because of the governor's race? Tell us your thoughts. What are your questions for our political analysts? Rene Rocha of the University of Iowa, Dave Anderson of Iowa State University. We'll be back in just a moment to talk about that. And also, Steve King, a poll that shows Steve King has a competitive race as well. It's Politics Wednesday edition of River to River, back in just a moment. Glad you're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The Trump administration is considering redefining the definition of gender under some civil rights laws, and that's a move that has sparked concern among those who are in the transgender, non-binary, and intersex community across the country. Tomorrow on this program, we'll hear how members of Iowa's LGBTQ community are responding to this possible change. We'd like to have you join our conversation, especially if you have an identity outside conventional notions of simply male or female. Tune in tomorrow as we talk about this possible move by the Trump administration, redefining the definition of gender under some civil rights law. That's tomorrow on the program. Today, it's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River. Rene Rocha, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. Dave Anderson, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. Our conversation of the week's politics bubbling along, and as we've been walking week by week up to the election, which is next Tuesday. And of course, early election has been ongoing now for several weeks. Make sure you do vote less than a week before Election Day. And this week on Politics Day, we want to focus on the governor's race. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds locked in a tight race against businessman Fred Hubble, viewed as one of the most competitive gubernatorial contests in the country. Dave, what is making this race so competitive?
Well, I think the top thing is that in the state of Iowa, the two parties are relatively balanced. Iowa has a long tradition of having a very even divide between Republicans and Democrats. I think over the last 10 years, the state has become much more conservative and Republican, but this is a Democratic year. Democrats across the country are going to do better this year because there is a souring of the mood towards President Trump and the Republican Party, and that makes it a near even balance here in Iowa.
Mm-hmm. So you are saying that the Trump factor, if I can put it that way, is a factor here. The Governor Reynolds has shown herself many times before the press in appearances with President Trump.
Yeah, this is a very typical thing. First-term presidents typically have the country kind of turn against them in their first midterm election. Famously, Barack Obama in his 2010 midterm got absolutely destroyed across the nation with Republicans winning state houses, governorships, Congress. Mm-hmm. And we don't know if it's going to be on that magnitude for the Republican Party this year, but it certainly looks like it is a Democratic year.
Before I hear your comment, Renee, on this race, let's listen to part of an excerpt from the final debate between Iowa's gubernatorial candidates, Kim Reynolds and Fred Hubble. It included some heated exchanges if you watched it or listened to it on October 21st. Hubble criticized Governor Reynolds' mental health care plan, which he says creates, quote, more unfunded mandates for local communities. He also called for increased funding for mental health services in public schools. Here's a bit of the exchange that followed.
Governor. More scare tactics, money. I have no idea, except for to raise your taxes, how Fred is going to even come close to paying for all of the promises that he's made. That's his answer to everything. It's more government and it's more money. And I'm telling you, Iowa taxpayers can't afford Fred Hubble.
Governor, you're the one pushing all the increased taxes down to the local community property taxpayers.
We're funding it. The managed care contract negotiations that we just implemented actually takes into account the comprehensive mental health care reform, and it helps us start to implement the initiatives that your running mate voted for. Every single legislator, you keep talking about how insignificant this is, but yet every single legislator, everyone voted for this, and it builds on the progress that we made in 2013. And if you say it enough and tell people enough, they're going to start to believe it. But the fact of the matter is, you're talking about stuff and we're getting things done.
Do you have a response, Mr. Hubble?
Yes, thank you. The governor's bill has a lot of nice words in it, which is why a lot of people voted for it. But there's no funding, there's no action, nothing has changed. She's just pushing costs and ideas down to local communities. They don't have the money to do these things. I talked to these people all across the state. They're not implementing any of those suggestions in that bill because they don't have the money for it and the state's not giving them any money.
Okay, a little bit of that debate from October 21st, the to and fro of Fred Hubble and Governor Kim Reynolds. Renee, have your comment on this race or perhaps something in that exchange.
Yeah, well, what's really interesting, we're talking about the Trump factor being a significant effect here, but that was just a classic Republican-Democrat divide
mold we've seen for how long?
Exactly. And, you know, what is Governor Reynolds talking about? She's talking about taxes and budgets and, you know, very sort of traditional Republican issues, not talking about as much the sort of more bombastic social cultural war type issues. We've seen Fred Hubble talk about a sort of a broader swath of stuff. He's talking about some social welfare programs, investing. You know, I've seen an ad talking about his support for Planned Parenthood. But Governor Reynolds seems to have stuck in pretty strictly to a pretty traditional script.
Mm-hmm. Dave, when you think about the issues these competitors have been mentioning in debates or otherwise, which of these do you think has the most traction? We mentioned Trump as being perhaps a drag on this and other Republican governors in office running for re-election.
Yeah, I think the two candidates are really not talking about Trump very much. I think the issues they're trying to focus on are Medicaid, the budget, the general economy in Iowa. And my sense is that the people who are paying attention to them, I think Kim Reynolds has done a better job of defining her personality and herself, whereas mm-hmm. Fred Hubble has done a better job of talking about issues. But I still think that a lot of voters this cycle are focusing more on the national tenor, and the state-level discussion is almost getting washed out.
Mm-hmm. Give me a sense, a little more in-depth, of the issues that are being discussed. Medicaid here, this has to do, what, Dave, with the privatization of the management of Medicaid in the state?
Yes. The state privatized Medicaid under Governor Branstad, and Kim Reynolds kind of inherited it and has been defending it. But its detractors are arguing that it has become more expensive than it was supposed to be, and that we have been cutting back on services, which is harming lots of Iowans who depend on Medicaid for their daily survival in some ways. And Fred Hupel has done a good job of getting people on camera in his commercials saying, hey, I am personally being harmed by this expansion or the privatization of Medicaid, and it is also much more expensive than we thought it would be. And I think those are some very good ads that resonate. And I think on the opposite side, Kim Reynolds has put out some really great ads that define her as a mother and a grandmother and as a very typical hardworking Iowan. They're very different campaigns. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's close. But it looks like the national tenor leaning towards Democrats is putting Hubble in the lead.
Mm-hmm. Let's listen to a couple of the ads now that you mentioned them. These are recent ads put out, one from each campaign. We'll just listen to them back to back and have you comment a little bit about the ad war here. Here's an ad called Clear, released last week. The Reynolds campaign plays to the fears that Hubble will raise taxes for Iowans.
I want to be very clear. I'm not going to raise taxes.
But Fred Hubble isn't telling the truth. Listen.
We're going to have to peel back all those tax cuts. We're going to have to peel back all those tax cuts. I'm talking about all the tax cuts. All the tax cuts.
So when you hear Hubble say,
it's a false, made-up attack.
Remember.
We're going to have to peel back all those tax cuts. We're going to have to peel back all those tax cuts. I'm talking about all the tax cuts. All the tax cuts.
Fred Hubble. He's liberal. He's lying. And he's going to raise your taxes.
Now, Hubble's ad called Another Show combats Reynolds' claims.
Don't believe Kim Reynolds' latest lies. Fred Hubble opposes raising taxes on middle-class families. But Reynolds is giving tax cuts to the wealthy and out-of-state corporations.
We've seen this show before. This governor is taking money we don't have and giving it to companies that don't need it. I came in and helped clean up the film tax credit scandal. I helped put an end to these taxpayer giveaways once, and I'll do it again. It's time we start growing Iowa the right way.
Okay, so lies, lying, featured in both of those ads, Renee. What do you think?
Yeah, and that's certainly been sort of the tenor of this campaign. Is negative advertising has really sort of dominated the airwaves recently.
Dave, when you hear those ads, does this ring true of the last days of a campaign? This is the all out. This is when if you're going to go negative, which has already been gone, you know, we were already there, but this is where you get your most negative ads out, right?
Sure, absolutely. The last week of a campaign, especially when it's this close, both campaigns are going to go very negative. They're going to appeal to their base, and they're going to appeal to the fears of the electorate and try to scare them into believing that their opponent is really going to harm their daily lives.
Mm-hmm. Dave, what does political science tell us about how voters make their decisions in this or any race? I mean, we have party affiliation, we have the issues, we have simple likability or simply, you know, I like him or her as a candidate. What do we know about how voters make decisions?
Well, we know a tremendous amount. The number one thing that influences most people's vote is their own personal partisanship. The moment you declare yourself a Republican or a Democrat, you become exponentially more likely to vote for those type of candidates for the rest of your life, whatever they stand for, which helps explain why the parties can change their issues so frequently and their voter base just stays with them. So we know that. We also know in midterm elections, a lot of people make their votes based upon their approval for the president, which seems bizarre because aside from Congress, this is a state level race that we're talking about right now. And yet, approval for the president probably influences a lot of people's votes at the state level. Mm-hmm. And we also know that the economy matters. And we have an unusual economy right now that, according to most statistics, unemployment, GDP, the economy is doing very well. But it's an open question whether people are really feeling that, because it seems like more and more people every year are just suffering under stagnating wages, increasing costs, and are kind of losing ground in the economy. So this is going to be an interesting year to see how people make their votes and if it's any different than other years.
Mm-hmm. We have a change on the voting ballot here in Iowa, which may affect this or not, Dave. The first time that voters are not able to vote a straight party ticket in one fell swoop, right? In previous elections, you could mark one circle if you were decided, I want to be straight Republican all the way down this ballot or straight Democrat all the way down this ballot, right, to certain judgeships or to that point as well, right?
Sure, and that really could have an effect because a lot of people, when they go to vote, have only ever heard of the top tier candidates. So most people will hear about the governor's race and make up a decision on who they prefer in the governor's seat. And they will also probably hear about their congressional district candidates. But most people don't learn much about offices farther down the ballot. Even Secretary of State, things like the county recorder. Most people just have no idea who the candidates are for these positions and what they stand for. They're not really sure what the job does or entails. So they don't have a lot to go on. It was a lot easier when you could just say, well, I like the Republican candidate for governor, so I'm going to give a Republican straight ticket. And it saved you the challenge of looking at all these names that you've never heard of and figuring out who you want to support for offices that you may not understand.
Let's go to our phones. Going to get rid of Ryan there. Ryan in Iowa City. Something going wrong with our phones at this point. We'll stick with the conversation. My ear is still ringing. Let's talk a little bit about Steve King's experiences over the last few days, a back and forth there within his own party. Representative Steve Stivers of Ohio, the chair of the National Republican Congressional Committee, had some harsh words for Steve King of Iowa's 4th District, declaring, quote, "We must stand up against white supremacy and hate in all forms." This comes after, you know, incendiary, racially charged comments by King, notably in the last few days, an endorsement of a white nationalist running for mayor of Toronto. His meeting with white nationalists, Austrian white nationalists. Here is Representative Stivers. Remember, this is a Republican from Ohio. Congressman Steve King's recent comments, actions, and retweets are completely inappropriate. We must stand up against white supremacy and hate in all forms, and I strongly condemn this behavior. Representative King firing back with a statement of his own. He affirmed that Americans of all races and national origins, legal immigrants, and natural-born citizens are created equal. He blamed attacks on him as orchestrated by nasty, desperate, and dishonest fake news, aided by complicit establishment never-Trumpers. Okay, so I threw it all out there. Renee, comment on this dust-up between the chair of the National Republican Congressional Committee and Steve King, who is no stranger to controversy, certainly, over years.
Yeah, and, you know, the Republican leadership has never really fully embraced Steve King, and I think many of those individuals have actually sort of viewed him as a little bit of a distraction from the more serious business of governing and legislating. And so, you know, they're obviously going to be inclined to offer that type of rebuke. I think they'd still rather have him than a Democrat in that seat, right? And so that must cause some trepidation. And I'm curious as to how strong these rebukes are now that the race appears to be tightening, rather than, you know, if he's up by 10 or 15 points, you can condemn him. You know that your condemnation is not going to lower the odds that he actually wins that election, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting to see that strength in a race that appears to be tightening, although I think most analysts agree that Representative King is still favored to win re-election.
Mm-hmm. Dave, do you see the race tightening here?
Absolutely. This seems like it has been a fairly competitive race since probably late summer, and that's unusual in the 4th. Steve King usually wins re-election with about 60% of the vote. It's a very safe, comfortable seat, but I think there's a combination of factors that are making this a very close race this cycle, and it really may come down to just a couple percentage points on Election Day.
Couple percentage points when he has normally won in his, what, 8 previous races by double digits?
By double digits, yes.
Aside from when he was opposed by Christy Vilsack, I think he's always won by double digits. It's been a very easy win for him most years. And this year, just a number of things are working against him.
Mm-hmm. Now, even his local newspaper, the Sioux City Journal, which had endorsed him in previous races, instead endorsed Scholten here. This is from the endorsement, the editorial in the Sioux City Journal. Each time King immerses himself in controversy, he holds up this district to ridicule and marginalizes himself within the legislative body he serves. The newspaper's editorial writing this and finishing up with, neither of which provides benefits to Iowans who live and work here. For those who may not be acquainted with Steve King, Renee, remind us of some of the controversial, I mean, these go back years. He is known nationally in the national press as someone who regularly gets attention for these comments.
Yeah, and this is his brand, and particularly sort of anti-immigrant native sentiments are his brand too. I mean, he's the one who talked about you know, children crossing the Arizona desert with calves the size of cantaloupes because they were carrying, you know, 75 pounds of marijuana on their back as they made their journeys, which anyone who's ever sort of spent time walking around the Tucson desert can probably guess that most people doing that aren't carrying a 75-pound load while that happens. But that's the sort of imagery and the sort of rhetoric, you know, compatible with some of the things that the president says that he's been talking about for well over a decade. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And more recently, Dave, have you been following what he's you're there in the fourth district recently, the ones that perhaps broke the straw on the camel's back for the Sioux City Journal and others? I don't know.
His recent endorsement of the mayoral candidate in Toronto, his meeting with the Austrian white nationalists, really has kind of put the nail in the coffin of doubts about his beliefs. For a long time, he's had what sounds like white nationalist beliefs. He retweets some white nationalists and then comes out and says, well, I didn't know what they stood for. I was just retweeting this sentiment. He says very controversial things that sounds like white nationalism, and he says it was taken out of context. But it's really hard to take this out of context. When he has this track record, he's already sowed doubts about whether he is a white nationalist himself. And then when he starts endorsing and meeting with obvious white nationalist candidates abroad, I think people say, well, we have to stop pretending these aren't your beliefs. This is apparently what you stand for, and we can't support that.
Mm-hmm. We had some of King's corporate donors cut ties with the representative recently, the Midwestern dairy giant, Land O'Lakes, withdrew its support, saying in a statement that it wants its, in its words, contributions to be a positive force for good. Tell us a little bit about his opponent, because this is all focused on Steve King. Mr. Scholten must be doing something right here as well if the polls are tightening.
Sure. J.D. Scholten has really transformed himself into what I would call a quality candidate. Regardless of his beliefs, there are things we like to see out of a candidate, and J.D. Scholten does those things. He is working very hard, going out to lots of events. He's meeting people of all different types throughout the district, so he's not just trying to cater to the base. He's not just talking to Democrats within the 4th District, which would not win him the district. He's going out and talking to Republicans and talking to independents and talking to people who have supported Steve King in the past, and he's making an argument that they should vote for it. And I think he's pointing out some of the weaknesses of King's tenure in Congress. And Steve King really has not confronted this. Throughout the race, he's refused to debate J.D. Scholten, saying, well, everybody knows what I stand for, so I don't really need to debate him. You can figure it out for yourself. King doesn't seem to be campaigning particularly hard. And I think the district is looking around saying, well, one of these candidates is working hard, and this other, our representative doesn't seem to be doing a lot for the district. He doesn't bring a lot of money back. He doesn't bring a lot of positive attention to the district. And it's sowing doubts. To be fair to Representative King, though, his viewpoints probably represent that district better than J.D. Scholten does. But I think his constituents are starting to wonder whether that's enough.
Mm-hmm. So we started off this election season thinking, well, the first and the third were the only competitive districts in Iowa of the four. Now you want to add the fourth to that, both of you, I guess.
I'm comfortable saying that it leans Republican still. I think if J.D. Scholten gets a little bit of luck on his side on Election Day, depending on what current events come out, depending on late-breaking trends in the electorate, he could be able to sneak into a victory here.
Mm-hmm. And you Renee, know, yeah. And the issue is that if the fourth is competitive, what does it say about the first and the third?
Yeah.
Right. And you know, I mean, the first looks like it's really leaning Democratic, and the third I think is the most interesting race in the state right now, because that looks like that might end up working out for the Democrats as well, quite possibly.
Okay, this is all to do with polls. We all have a little bit different view of polls after 2016, so mm-hmm. I guess we all get our grains of salt there, Dave. Renee?
Well, I would defend the polls in 2016 a bit, but we don't have time.
Okay, you're right, we do. We'll put that on the back burner for another time to cook it up on a politics day. Dave Anderson of Iowa State University, Renee Rocha at the University of Iowa. Thank you both for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Ben.
Coming up tomorrow on the program, I'm going to talk about, we'll jump off the news from a few days ago that the Trump administration is considering redefining the definition of gender under some civil rights laws. That has some people in transgender, non-binary, and intersex communities across the country concerned. We'll hear tomorrow how members of Iowa's LGBTQ community are responding. Do you have an identity outside the conventional notions of simply male or female? Join our conversation tomorrow on the program. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.